Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a power-packed show for you today. The latest, of course, on health and nutrition. More on the environment, just if nothing else to show you what's happening around the world. Several commentaries, a guest who will be with us in the second part of our program, talking about did the National Security Agency have information adequate to have prevented the attacks on 9/11? Hard documentation, and I'll share it with you with my guest. Also today, we'll have your questions from Elizabeth McCormick, and people have been writing in comments and questions, and I'll see what they are when she asks. And also a video audio clip about the history of consumerism, one that is extremely well done. So I'll share that with you also. So let's begin. Right up at the top of our program, we want to talk about when you eat, and if you do not eat organic, you do risk getting glyphosate. That is the herbicide from which Roundup is made. And now, according to University of California, San Diego, there's a 1,200% increase in human glyphosate levels. So the environmental dangers of glyphosate in Roundup and other weed-killing products have been well documented. Now, new research from a team led by Paul Mills at the university has found that it could be negatively affecting human health, and especially in lower-income communities. The study tracked people in Southern California over the age of 50 for a number of years, and they found that, wow, people are loaded with this chemical, and that's a hormone disruptor, and that could be contributing to higher risks of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, something I discuss on a regular basis here. Research out of King's College in London found this toxic herbicide ingredient can cause non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in animals. And by the way, this amount is 437,000 times below levels that are allowed in the U.S. And in more recent research, the level of glyphosate in human studies were proportionally 100-fold higher. So what it means is they're finding that less of it causes major conditions, and we're getting a lot more of it. So it's a double negative. And so historically, and in fact, when I go clear back to when I was just getting involved in the environmental movement, and I was only 18 years old, and we were told, well, yes, DDT is bad, but you're getting it in such small quantities, parts per million. Well, now we know parts per billion are toxic. So we were given misinformation from the toxicology data on these. And these can disrupt your hormones. They can disrupt your brain. So you don't want anything to do with this probable human carcinogen, according to the World Health Organization. And it does cause liver damage, and even in the amounts found in tap water. So currently 90 million Americans have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. That's associated with diabetes, obesity, and metabolic syndrome, also increasing. So we're a very sick nation at this moment, and I really believe that we all have a responsibility to share information, articles, documentaries, whatever you have available to those you care about, then step back and say, I would like for you to see if you find anything of value in this. Then let them watch it or read it or listen to it and say, no, it didn't make any sense. I don't care what you say. Or, hey, that got my attention. I was not aware of that. Oh, and by the way, I watched a preview this morning of a new documentary that was put out. The documentary is just some talking heads, unfortunately, and wasn't edited, in my opinion, in a way that would hold people's interest. However, one of the things that was stated in there, and a graph was shown, is that 87% of parents in the United States now question the safety and efficacy of vaccines. They want more information. Now, historically, the only people providing that information were physicians, who generally would do nothing more than say, I wouldn't be giving to you if I had any doubts about its safety or efficacy. Or the CDC would give an official pronouncement, there's no connection between vaccines and anything, though there have on occasion been some hot lots, or there's been some DNA or gene-sensitive individuals who may have ended up with some problems, but that's rare. All that is lies, and now the public is finally finding out about it. Good. It's just like the Me Too. Well, now parents, the Me Too parents, are coming forward. And you just put yourself in the position of a parent whose child has been developing normally, laughing, crawling, standing, verbalizing, eye contact, responding to human emotions and gestures, gets their shots, and now doesn't do any of the above. Just cries incessantly, will sit in a corner and bang their head against a wall, repetitive motions. The parent goes to the doctor and says, what happened to my child? And the doctor says, well, it wasn't a vaccine, and he'll probably get over it. But the child doesn't get over it. The doctor takes no responsibility. So I believe at this point that we must, as a nation, begin to honor those 2 million parents who have autistic children and another 2 million parents who have some form of minimal brain dysfunction or retardative learning capacities. They take longer. They're more difficult. They take special education. Because now you're dealing with 4 million people, and many of them are themselves doctors. I interviewed a woman who was a physician, gave her own child the vaccines, and saw the child regress into autism, and she was a pediatrician, changed her whole perspective. And I said, but had your child not receded into autism, would you have listened to the other parents whose children did? And she said, no, I wouldn't have. So that gets us to a larger issue. And I don't know if I'll have, I'm going to try to make time for this answer because I feel it's very important. Why are we so resistant to change, even looking at information that could change our perception and perspective? For example, 900,000 plus doctors in the United States, and less than one-tenth of 1% have challenged the existing medical paradigm. And the medical paradigm, with the exception of emergency medicine, which is terrific, has failed completely for 50 years. I did a report with four other physicians and PhDs, and these were scholars and specialists in research methodology. It took us 5 years. We reviewed only orthodox statistics from major institutions and came to the conclusion that the number one cause of death in the United States and injury was iatrogenesis, or medically induced. We submitted this with all of our footnotes and research to 7,000 publications. Not one responded. Not even a rejection, just no response. Now, I've had many articles published, one just 2 months ago in a respected peer-reviewed journal. All of my studies have had publication and presentation, but on this, complete disconnect. It's like if you're an excommunicado, you're not going to be spoken with at all, as if you don't exist, if we don't say anything about this new study, because it would be, if paid attention to, the single greatest indictment against American healthcare in American history. It would show our system doesn't work. It's profitable. Boy, does it work for making people money. But it fails. So that's what I couldn't get through. Anyone, liberal, conservative, it didn't matter. I just couldn't get them to understand it. Some intellectual disconnect that the existing system, whether it's a universal care, which I support, where you don't pay out of your pocket. We may pay taxes 1% extra, and we can save what it would cost us. So it's going to cost nothing new. In fact, it would save us $2 trillion a year. So the economics is on the side of universal health care. But what was important is, let's just say that you said, well, we want everybody to be insured, but what if the treatment they're getting is killing them and injuring them? And they never went that deep. They never went that far to think about that. So we have a lot of shallow thinkers. Don't you want a medical system that actually prevents disease in the first place, is honest about what are the best therapies, and does not exclude therapy simply because of the politics of misalignment? You do not want homeopathy, chiropractic, naturopathy, massage, music therapy, psychoneuroimmunology, exercise physiology, meditation, yoga, cleansing diets, detox diets. You don't want any of that to compete with the existing medical paradigm. So the irony of it is, you walk into a hospital ward and a cancer ward, and you see people eating the very food that caused their disease with no sense of commission by the dietitian or the physician. No one pays attention. Whereas when you go to certain clinics, and only five clinics that I'm aware of personally at this time from my own research that can help reverse terminal cancer, they're never going to feed you any of that because they know it causes high inflammatory response and hormone dysregulation that can lead to breast cancer, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer, etc. So we're not even at a point where we're willing to acknowledge certain foods are dangerous and others are not. And if the medical community, the higher authority, in deference to the truth, does not recognize it, then what would a person who is further down the scale, let's say a lesser educated individual, what would they do? They're not going to question anything. So if it's a television program called Man and Food, I haven't seen it. I guess it's off the air now. But someone even told me the guy became a vegan. I don't know if that's true or not. In any case, the object of the exercise was for him to go into a popular restaurant, and generally the most popular restaurant in a given city, a different city each show, and have a group of people cheer him on, and it was like a prize fight, except the food was that he was eating was the opposition. And they would do some going into the kitchen, and he would eat 6 pounds of a given item. 6 pounds. Well, I did the math on just one show to see how many total calories. It was excess of 12,000 calories from one meal. The fact that he was able to live after eating that is amazing, because I did a study at the Tri-State Healing Center in the 1990s where we took blood in the morning and gave people certain juices like beet juice and coconut water and a mixture of watermelon juice, and their blood was beet red, which is what you want, highly oxygenated, thin blood. And then we had people who would normally eat a bad meal go out and eat a bad meal and come back. And then an hour later, we would take their blood, and it was just like a milkshake. And as I point out, see those strings there? That's fat. And that fat is sticking to, it's very adhesive. It's sticking to platelets, and those platelets can form a clump, and that clump can then become a clot, and the clot can clog your artery going into your heart or your brain, and you can have an ischemic episode or a cardiac event. And generally, a lot of heart attacks happen after a fast food meal. But you take a vegan meal, a plant-based meal, you take juicing, oh, your blood looks great afterwards. So anyhow, there's no debate. There is no debate whatsoever left in health and nutrition, none. We have hundreds of thousands of studies done at the best institutions showing what will cause disease. So the fact that we're even talking about what causes disease is not the problem. The problem is we deal in our society in a hierarchical order. The highest achieved person in a given field is considered the authority figure. Now, it only works, that person's only an authority figure, if they are in the established order. So you have to be in the game and accepted as a member of the game, before you're acknowledged for your achievements in that field. Even if your achievements are nothing more than being famous and successful, you could be a top oncologist. You could be voted the number one oncologist in America, but no one will ever ask how many of your terminal patients are alive and well 5 years later. The answer would be zero. And how many of your patients do you give chemotherapy and radiation to? And the answer would be all of them. Then the question would be, well, how many of those survived? And then a few, now they weren't terminal. So do you give any credit at all for their survival to the person's own determination, their own immune function, their own life choices, since you weren't following their diet, so you eat anything you want? So let's just say you happen to have a cancer patient but decide to be motivated to eat a healthy diet and to take some juices and start taking curcumin and cayenne and vitamin C and quercetin and indole-3-carbinol and isothiocyanates and all the other anti-cancer ingredients. Will you give any of that credit for the reversal of cancer? And the answer is, of course we won't. So you take 100% of the credit of a person who survives breast cancer, and you give none to the patient. That is correct. But you take no responsibility for all the patients that die. Well, in a way we do, because we say the person is fighting the good fight, and therefore it was a hard-fought battle. So in other words, you militarize the construct of how you work with a patient, but nowhere in there is there, Ian, they mentioned the things that actually can reverse cancer or cause cancer to begin with. You already start with a determination. The determination is genetic. And if you're not willing to look at stress, lack of exercise, diet, then the real causes for 96% of all cancers will evade you. So you have to ask, how do these so-called bright men and women from Harvard, Columbia, Yale, how do they end up being so stupid? I mean, ravenously stupid. They actually grovel at the bowl of stupidity each day and gobbledygook that stuff in as if somehow they're going to help you. And yet the average person is so dim-witted, they're so far down the line with common sense and reason that they just, whatever the doctor says, they'll go along with, because they feel helpless. They do not feel intoned with that mystical alchemy of artificial belief. And today's medicine is no better than yesterday's alchemy. Do not be confused by the high-level technology and how many tests they do. After all, when was the last time you went to a doctor, any doctor, that before they gave you tests, they talk with you, ask you how you feel, how long you had this, how did it manifest? Do you know anything you could have been doing that could have precipitated it? No, you get the test first. Why? Everybody profits from the tests. And that's how it begins. What you actually have and what the causes are of secondary importance. So when you get mistreated and overtreated and misdiagnosed, it shouldn't come as a surprise. So just, you know, something to consider, because that's how the system works. So when they're telling us, oh, glyphosate doesn't hurt you, yes, it does. They're lying. And here's one more dot on that. This is from Dr. Jonathan Latham from Biotechnology Commentaries Environment. Quote, the biotech industry is taking over the regulation of GMOs from the inside. The Spain-based nonprofit Grain recently revealed that agribusiness takeover of CONABIA, the National Advisory Committee on Agricultural Biotechnology of Argentina. CONABIA is the GMO assessment body of Argentina. According to Grain, 26 of 34 of its members were either agribusiness company employees or had major conflicts of interest. Packing a regulatory agency with conflicted individuals is one way to ensure speedy GMO approvals, and CONABIA has certainly delivered that. A much more subtle but ultimately more powerful way is to bake approval into the structure of the GMO assessment process itself. It is easier than you may think. So here he is explaining how when a country, in this case Argentina, says, we don't want GMOs, the farmers, we don't want them, the public, we don't want them, the activists certainly don't, and educated consumers don't. But the fix was in. You get people from the very industries to sit on your advisory board, and they say, yes, we need it, and suddenly it's in. No different than the type of vaccines you get. The very people sitting on the CDC and FDA advisory boards come from the very industries that make those vaccines. And therefore, they have a gross conflict of interest, and yet that's the way all business is done in the swamp of Washington, D.C. So it's to you to become educated. So I get back to my original question. Why is a nation, now there are individuals, of course, that make up their mind, do their own homework, are not caught by the wave of consensus. But for the average person in this country, if you look at the total number of people who have made really egregious errors in their health and in their work and in other areas of their life, why aren't we able to ask ourselves these questions in order to change, to transform our beliefs and values? I'd like to hear what you have to say on this a little later. I will try to get your calls at 888-874-4888. Also, from the University of Rochester, to calm your emotions, get 15 minutes alone. That's correct. Being by yourself, no cell phones, no distractions, no computer, just being alone can decrease your strong positive and negative emotions and instead reduces stress and induces calm. So leading researcher on this with background in social sciences and psychology, University of Rochester, did this study, and that's what they found. But Americans don't give themselves 15 seconds of calm alone time, let alone 15 minutes. And hence the problems. So, that alone time. And by the way, at my latest retreat, some people had no problem sitting with nature and for hours. And other people, not 2 seconds could they shut up or be alone. Nonstop. They had to have that distraction of the presence of others. And I'd have conversations on all this. Did you say anything? Did you learn anything in that conversation that was so relevant that it took away the time you could have been with nature and looking at the eagles flying above your head? No. So why not try just being alone? I can't. Why not? I'm hyper-agitated when I'm alone. So every day, all day, I'm always distracted. I got the radio on, got television, got my computer, got my cell phone. I keep constantly distracted. I go from many, and if I really want to be distracted, I go from many crises to many dramas. I stay in perpetual drama or crisis, so everyone else has to pay attention to me. Wow. All right? So try alone time without distraction. And finally, research in the University of Alabama shows that you can reduce your risk of heart disease by eating 2 delicious fruits loaded with essential minerals for the heart. So this is a very important study showing that consumption of enough potassium, an essential mineral, can actually reduce the risk of heart disease. Now we know that potassium can improve kidney health, brain function, blood sugar relation, and muscle strength. Yeah, that we know. But potassium also is great for the heart. So avocados and bananas. Avocados are a fruit, by the way. And organic varieties would be best. So that would be a way of getting your potassium, and that can lead to aortic pliability, where otherwise you could be aortic stiff, and calcified arteries it could help eliminate. So want to have a healthier heart? Bananas and avocados. And by the way, you can actually put bananas and avocados together, blend them in a blender, and make a great smoothie. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go over now and say hello to Elizabeth McCormick standing by. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. This was a question that came in today.
And by the way,
today,
before you get to your question,
yeah,
if
sure.
people want to ask, share information or bring me up to date, maybe on a documentary I don't know about or an article that's floating around the Internet that I could read to the audience would be beneficial, or ask a question, tell them how to do that.
They would email us at prnstudio@gmail.com.
That's prnstudio@gmail.com. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay.
What's your question?
We have a question that came in today following your show last night on the Progressive Radio Network. I have just finished listening to the 2.5-hour special on Hillary and Bill Clinton. It was the most insightful and insightful chronology of their history I have ever heard. I'm going to suggest it to my colleagues, other journalists, that they listen. I only know some of what was presented, but quite frankly, would not have had the courage to expose them quite that way, as I know how powerful they are and that they would do everything they can to hurt and destroy you. If this information gets widely known, then they are finished. And the question they have is, are you concerned about attacks against you? And they say, please keep on doing your good work, and they'll keep on sharing it.
Okay. For those of you who are not aware what this person was asking or stating, last night I did a 2.5-hour special on the history of the Clintons, and it was based upon a true chronology of actual events that are provable, that are documented, not speculative or specious statements. And I went clear back to the time when he was an Oxford student, the assertion against him of rape, his getting out of Oxford, not graduating, and his who was behind him to get him into politics, who paid his way in, who were his mentors, and even who got him to be the Democratic nominee. A woman named Harrington. Yeah, that same Harrington. And I gave a whole history of the Clintons and their missteps, misdeeds. And I brought it right up to date, because if you're going to vote for a person because of what they say, shouldn't you check the veracity of their claims to see if it is legitimate? And nothing that they have said is legitimate. They say they're for women. Which women specifically? Some of your wealthy friends, you know, but not the women that I know, not the women in countries I travel to, certainly not in the women in the Middle East and in repressive regimes like Saudi Arabia. And certainly she's not for the women, if you're a liberal or unionist, if you're a progressive in Honduras, she's not for you, because she caused a coup and it caused many of them to be murdered, including the chief environmental woman down in Honduras and in other countries. And then I went through a whole list, actual material, not supposition. So everything that she has said that she would do, she has done just the opposite. So I just want people to realize they're not going away. And the reason they're not going away, the reason that it won't happen to them what happened to Matt Lauer today, where he was fired, and Charlie Rose, is because Charlie Rose, just think of it, think of the people, Harvey Weinstein and Jeffrey Epstein, the people that you've seen embarrassed and humiliated because of accusations of their sexual misconduct, their reputations are now forever tarnished. And the reason that they will not come back into power is because they never actually had the power. The Clintons actually start with power. Money is not their motive. Celebrity status is not their motive. Power is. And they're a brand. And you see, NBC couldn't afford to damage its brand. That's why it got rid of the Matt Lauer. And the studios that were affiliated with either financing or co-producing or distributing Weinstein's films, he's not the brand. what he once was, but why do you think his reputation was protected for so long? Because people needed him, not feared him, they needed him. So we have this kind of duplicitous notion in our society, and it shouldn't exist. If we need someone, suddenly we're willing to give them a pass. And there's a whole, a legion of corporate liberal Democrats that have needed the Clintons because of what the Clintons do for people. And just look at who gets the money, who gets the no-bid contracts, who gets on the inside track, who gets important jobs. And that's how you create a whole lot of goodwill and also people having your back. If anyone else did even 1% of what the Clintons have done, they would have been excommunicated from the body politic forever. But you got to go back to Arkansas to see that history. And people don't go that far. But, well, that's yesterday. It's old news. Well, if you rape someone, it doesn't matter how old the news is. If you're known for stealing from the society and the taxpayers through the development fund in Arkansas, and who said that? The man who ran it. The man who sat at the breakfast table with Bill and Hillary every morning and planned what their strategy is going to be. The man who saw that where the dollars went. So you're not talking about an outsider, a third person hearsay. You're talking about someone actually was involved in the crimes and misdemeanors revealing this information. So why can't the New York Times actually focus? Why can't the New York Times sit down and ask Bill Clinton, what exactly motivated you while your wife was senator to go on a Lolita Express to an orgy island with a pedophile 25 times, and five of those trips without your Secret Service detail, where those five villas down there are just for orgies, nothing else, with underage girls. Epstein didn't like girls over the age of 14. Some were as young as 12. And Clinton would be asked to describe that. What was his purpose of being there? Your wife was in public office. You're an ex-president. But no one ever brought it up. That shows you the deference we play to power when you become a brand, and the Clintons branded themselves and monikered themselves in the democratic process. There are a whole lot better women in this world that would represent women and human rights. Jill Stein is the best example, but she's not alone. Frances Moore LePay. I can name 100 to 1,000 women who would be better serving the public than the Clintons, and yet it shows you the corruption. It shows you the disingenuous nature of the rapacious mindset of people who say, I don't care what they've done, I don't care who they've done it to, I cannot afford not to be associated, I need their largesse. So that's what I exposed. So there it is. It's there for people to download. You can go to the archives. And if you want to go to the archives and just listen, I'll give you the phone number right now. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. Or just go to prn.fm and then go to the archives. It's a powerful show. Now to the second part. Am I afraid of retaliation? I'm not foolish. I'm not a martyr. But I do not come from fear. If I came from fear, I would have not done what I've been doing my entire life. I never will forget when I was on ABC, both ABC Network and WABC in New York. And each Sunday night when I would leave that three-hour show and I'd come out, I was alone. The whole office was closed. I'd look up and I'd see that ABC emblem and I'd say, wow, another week, an opportunity to reach people I would not otherwise be able to reach. And the reason why that was so important, because that's mainstream. So I was coming from a progressive background, but given a mainstream forum with no censorship at all, ever. That does not mean there was not pressure placed upon Mark Mason, program director, to censor me. There was, but he never once did that. And there's a photograph up on my website, I just saw it recently, of Mark Mason and myself on ABC with 5,000 letters just that week. I was getting 5,000 a week. So I had this humongous audience, not before. before since they had that size audience for a show. And then I started reading where I was being attacked, and I heard the attack by a doctor on ABC. And so I looked at the statement, and I sued him. And I sued ABC. And I sued the Pritikin program, and I sued Quaker. I sued a bunch of people. And I won. And they had to apologize. They all had to apologize. 6 times they had to apologize. And I said, next time you go to attack someone, buddy, you better do your homework, because I am one of those very litigious people. I'll sue your ass off. And I have the resources to do it. And I did. And I won. Because they had taken information from a quackbuster. And I debated this clown on national television, and he was just a boorish fool, an arrogant, narcissistic fool. He knew nothing about health and nutrition, had no background in it. He was a pathologist, but claimed he knew everything and knew nothing. And he looked really bad in that national debate. But then they let this information go out, and they got all these people to start reposting it everywhere. Every one of those people that posted it, we could track down. Well, they had to come to the court and realize, gee whiz, you can say anything as long as it's true, but you better make sure it's true. So that's something I tell other people. The fact that you're in the public eye does not mean anyone can say anything and get away with it. If they make any error, if there's any untruth, sue them. I did, I have, I will. So if Clintons want to come after me, let them. Now, there's two ways I believe the Clintons can come after you. One, there's no comeback to it. But the other one, yeah. The last thing any Clinton would ever want is a deposition and discovery, especially when I sick a bulldog group of lawyers that don't work for the hour. They work for the cause on their background. I'd love to see the Clintons in court. Am I afraid of the other nefarious things I've heard them do? No, I'm not. But right now there's an army of trolls working for Big Pharma, the CIA, working for every company that today wants to value its reputation and doesn't want its good name smeared, even if it's been doing bad things. And all of them go to these dark agencies like the old Blackwater, and they will say anything and do anything over the Internet to try to attack you. I expect that. I've had that my whole career. I don't pay attention to it. Unless it's something like on a network I am. And I still stayed on the network. I was right. They acknowledged it. You know, all the information about me was wrong. And so that's how it works. So, no, I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to stop anything I'm doing. But I also vet it very carefully. We send it through scholars and residents and lawyers before I present it to the public. Everything last night in 2.5 hours on the Clinton is accurate. Now, if anyone who wants to defend the Clintons want to come on and jabber about that, you can. I'll be happy to debate you. Because all the media is controlled by special interest groups, whether from the right or left. Very few media are independent and able to tell the truth. And even now, a lot of good media people and good journalists are being ostracized and attacked. And many of their attacks are these fandom attacks, these anonymous attacks where you don't know who's attacking you. So I just tell them, don't put your attention there. Put it doing the good work you're doing. Don't distract yourself. They want to distract you. They want to create fear in you. They want to create apprehension. Look, the worst that can happen is people who don't know you may be influenced not to want to know you. And the people who know you know not to give this nonsense any credibility. Hope that answers that question. Okay, Elizabeth?
Yes, thank you. That was a great answer, thanks.
Good. So we're going to keep exposing corruption. We're going to expose malfeasance. We're going to expose what we believe needs to be exposed. And I'll also continue to support Truth Dig and Truth Out and Counterpunch and Common Dreams Consortium News and all of the really good independent groups that are on the Internet fighting for our freedoms and truths, because they're doing good work. Now we're going to go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by. His name is Les Jamieson, J-A-M-I-E-S-O-N, and he is in New York. Nice to have you with us today, James. Les?
Yes, hello, Gary. Great to be with you.
By the way, Les has studied the alternative research on 9/11 since the beginning of that whole event, and he has been a major voice of responsible dialogue, along with thousands of scientists and engineers who have looked at the evidence and has simply come to a conclusion, as have I, that where we may not know the ultimate motives of those behind 9/11, we certainly can say with absolute confidence and scientific veracity that the official report was grossly in error and did not represent the truth. And these bits and pieces of truth have been coming out ever since, and especially architects and engineers for 9/11 truth. But that's not what we're here to talk about. By the way, Les has spearheaded efforts to generate public support for congressional legislation, which he did, that released the 20 pages from the Congressional Joint Inquiry on 9/11 that were sealed from the official 9/11 Commission report. And so that's what we're going to look at for a moment. We have had William Binney, the well-known whistleblower from the National Security Agency, on the program before. And when charges are made against the Bush administration and the FBI and the CIA regarding how much they knew before and after 9/11, we do not hear of the National Security Agency very much. However, according to Binney and other whistleblowers, the National Security Agency had the technology and the surveillance tools, being called the Thin Thread, that was their code name, to have prevented 9/11, as well as other terrorist attacks, but either failed or refused to use it. And Binney and others now insist that if the Thin Thread had been used, the attacks would not have occurred. Moreover, Thin Thread preserved citizens' privacy. Instead, another program, far less accurate and more cumbersome, called Stellar Wind, was employed by the National Security Agency. And for the average person, this may be a bit confusing. So do this, please. Explain what Thin Thread is from Binney and others' perspectives, and how would it have been possible to stop the 9/11 attacks? And what do we know so far for the reasons of it not being have been used?
Sure. Okay. Gary, Thin Thread technology was designed by William Binney and a colleague by the name of Ed Loomis. And what it did was scour the world's digital communications that was being all swept up in the bulk data collection activities of the NSA. And the way Thin Thread operated is it could detect suspicious patterns, could also detect communications coming in and out of known suspicious areas around the world. Specifically, for instance, in Yemen, there was a known safe house, an Al-Qaeda safe house. So it knew where to look for suspicious patterns. And once it did detect these suspicious patterns, Thin Thread then automatically notified all the relevant agencies and law enforcement to then react and take action. And this was done without the need for human interaction. Again, it was automatic. And a few years after the attacks, another whistleblower by the name of Thomas Drake took Thin Thread and applied it against the data that existed prior to 9/11, and he sure enough discovered elements of the attacks, specifically the activities of two of the accused hijackers in San Diego, who are also mentioned in the 28 pages. And this is a relation here with this information coming out through the release of the 28 pages. So Thin Thread would have detected their coming into the country, would have notified the relevant agencies, and would have been thwarted the attacks. And all of these whistleblowers, William Binney, Ed Loomis, Kirk Wiebe, Diane Rourke, and of course Ed Loomis, they all insist that 9/11 should have been prevented. But instead, interestingly, Gary, let's add some context here. In the months leading up to 9/11, there were a blizzard of warnings of coming from FBI field agents like Colleen Lowley. Also, the terrorism czar Richard Clark was trying to beat down the doors of people like John Ashcroft and others to get FaceTime with the president at the time because of his awareness of warnings. Richard Tenet was running around with his hair on fire. There was the August 6th presidential daily briefing, which the title was, "Bin Laden Determined to Strike Within the U.S. There were put options on United and American Airlines. There's, an overwhelming amount of indications of an impending attack. So the NSA, rather than use ThinThread, it shut it down 3 weeks prior to 9/11. Whoa, so now ask the question, why did this happen, and why then did the NSA turn around and implement far more pervasive surveillance techniques after 9/11? Why did it then take a program that only had cost $9.5 million and replace it with a program called Trailblazer, which right away stripped the three levels of encryption which protected our privacy? And why did it then offer out this need for surveillance after 9/11 to contractors like SAIC, which wound up costing $3.8 billion, but failed completely and was then shut down finally in 2005. So serious questions here. And by the way, this is all up at the website hr14.org, as well as action alerts, because right now what we're about to be faced with is a legislative decision. And Congress has to decide whether to allow Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to either expire, as it was scheduled to do by law due to an amendment in 2008, or to reinstate it or make it permanent. And there is legislation by Republican Tom Cotton of Arkansas to make Section 702 permanent. And what that does, Section 702 basically legalizes, to be really, really brief and condensed here, it legalizes the warrantless surveillance through a backdoor loophole where when communications are being tracked overseas and like say you or I calling somebody overseas or overseas calls coming in, they can then basically track us for investigation. And it's not just like Edward Snowden revealed, it's not just metadata, it's actual content. And along with this, we know that the telecom agencies such as Verizon, AT&T, and Google are all pressured by the NSA to divulge their records of our activities. So we are literally at a crossroads here where the surveillance state of, Orwellian proportions is about to be legalized and perpetuated.
Okay, we're up to the end of this segment. Let's just tell people, if you're opposed to a police state, then let your senator know that Senate Bill 1297, 1297, which is up for vote, you're against, because you don't want the FISA Act extended or made permanent, because then it's just people will forget about it, not realizing it's just one more way that they can look at everything in your life. So the bill is Senate Bill 1297, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. Yes,
Debbie, there is a page on HR14.org that has the specifics on the legislation, and we have another issue here where Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan may try to bury it in the year-end spending bill. So that's also at HR14.org.
Okay, good. Les, thank you very much. We'll keep in touch on this.
Great. Thank you,
now,
Gary.
Now, I want to take some time. Now, I'm going to save my environmental segment for tomorrow. I want to take some time to get your feedback on why we are so resistant to challenging authority like a medical, the AMA, and how medicine is taught, how banking is performed, how our food is grown, how our energy is created. We're just not willing, as a country, I certainly acknowledge and appreciate individuals, to take back our lives, take back our freedom, take back our capacity to have a sustainable life and a quality life in a moral society. Why? What do you believe is the cause? Call me at 888-874-4888. I'm going to play for you in a moment a short piece about a woman doing her own little rap. It's called This White Woman is Speaking Some Truth. That's the only title. I don't know who the woman is. And before that, I just got this email. I want to thank the person who wrote it. I'll just read it to you. This is from regards Randolph S. Gary, last night's program was so powerful that it immobilized me for a time. How can people be so beastly and uncaring about their utilization of power for their illegal and twisted aims? Tragically, so many tried to alert those who could have stopped these actions, but the lure of illicit money and career advancement were too strong a tool for self-dignity and ethics to overcome. The trouble is, everyone ends up being considered as a willing accomplice to these dirty deeds. Sadly, it is undermining the nation, as every increasing measure must be taken to stop more people getting in on the gravy train. Thankfully, your exposure, the research of these of those courageous people who have lost their lives to warn us of the corruption, it is in itself bravery beyond the call of duty. Sincerely, Randolph. Thank you, Randolph. I appreciate those input. Now, let's see if we have anyone online. Hopefully, we'll get some calls in. I'd like to take your calls. And let's say hello to Benjamin from Jersey City. Hi, Benjamin.
Hello, Gary. Well, with regards to your show today, when the doctor said that she wouldn't believe that vaccines can cause autism until her child developed autism, I think this is just a general picture of the narcissism, selfishness of our society. And we're into convenience. If something's not convenient, then we won't even think about it and we won't do it. And we're only interested in what's in front of our faces and the images we can see.
Okay. I think you're right on the button there, Benjamin. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. If someone else would like to call in, you have an opportunity now. And while you're waiting to call in, now that's starting to percolate up, and we'll get another person here in a second. Let's see who we have. I'm just waiting here. Rochelle from South Carolina. Hi, Rochelle, your turn.
Yes, hi, Gary. I'm only listening to you for 41 years. I have the answer to this. We were raised in the 50s. Doctor is God. In my home, the doctor was God. I know that you had a neighbor and you had an aunt and you had exceptions. But in my home in Great Neck, New York, and I just buried my brother. He's 10 years older. And I tried to... within the past 6 months, my sister-in-law was diagnosed with a very aggressive form of uterine cancer. And my brother just died just out of nowhere of leukemia. Okay, I sent them information for 35 to 40 years. Everything went in the garbage. I didn't even bother. They were both taking chemo together. I didn't even bother talking to them with this illness because I knew they would not listen to anything. They never did.
So, well, Rochelle, I'm sorry for your loss. And I also understand your frustration. I, too, was raised in the 1950s, and I, too, experienced our family doctor who smoked and drank. And when my mother, I asked her to stop smoking and drinking, she said, well, our doctor does. And that was it. It didn't matter, you know, that there was some contradictory standards. She accepted that. So once again, you've added a piece to our knowledge of the puzzle, and I appreciate you calling in and sharing that with us. All the best.
I just want to say their lifestyle was eat, drink, and be merry. That's their lifestyle, and they went down very quickly.
Well, merry isn't the state that people are in when they're dying of cancer.
No, I'm just saying that, no, their lifestyle before they got acutely ill was eat, drink, and be merry. That was it. They went on like over 40 cruises. I would never personally go on a cruise, but that's it. Thank you very much for taking my call.
All the best. And we're out of time. Bill from Long Island and Sarah and Lynn, please call in tomorrow. I'll be taking calls tomorrow, but we're out of time for now. Thank you all for listening. Do listen in and share that if you feel that after listening to the 2.5-hour special on the history of the Clintons, it gives you a better perspective, not just on the Clintons, but on all the people who need them to be in power, because it sanctifies and protects their power. And they don't want to give that up. And these are the technocrats, the bureaucrats, and the so-called best and brightest who are smart enough to be successful enough to be in their court. And boy, there's not a whole lot of difference between some of the ruling courts and royal courts and all the intrigue and politics and backbiting and self-serving nature and Machiavellian tendencies than it was with the Clintons. Have a nice day, everyone.